From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Fruitvale.
Adams Point.
Grand Lake neighborhood.
Maxwell Park.
I'm from Oakland, and I live in the Laurel District.
Today, we're asking questions about constructing identity. Like, how much can you tell about someone from the way they sound?
She said, I want you to sound so good that if I put you on stage behind a curtain, everyone would swear you were white.
Or what does a person gain and lose when they switch between racial identities?
This has been incredibly taxing emotionally, psychologically. I don't want to do this anymore.
And what if you don't want to choose between identities at all?
I'm bumping up against so much gendered language all day, every day. My preference would be for none of that to exist and for everything to be neutral.
Personal stories of identity and passing today on Cross Currents. Have you ever noticed how we adjust the way we speak depending on our social situation?
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey, what's up?
Hey!
What's up?
Hi.
Hey, how are you?
Hello.
Hey, girl.
What's going down with you? Linguists call it code switching. It was originally used for people who would switch between two different languages, like I do at home between English and Arabic. But the term has evolved to embrace the tone, accents, and inflections we use when talking to anyone. Many of us do it. Even our president does it. Here's a speech from Obama at the 2009 NAACP convention.
We need to go back to the time, back to the day when parents saw somebody, saw some kid fooling around. And it wasn't your child, but they'll whoop you anyway.
Although the crowd cheered the president on that day, not everyone embraced his code switching. Fox News surely didn't appreciate it.
But what was going on with the accent that he was affecting? I thought that was just weird.
How do our voices define us? In search of some answers, KALW's Leela Day decided to talk this one out. Growing up, I heard plenty of jokes about the way I spoke.
Listen to how you talk, like a white girl. Who you think you is?
You sound white when you're on the phone.
But I couldn't help the way I sounded. It's a default voice, just how I speak. You see, where I grew up in Las Vegas, there were two types of black kids in school. Those who hung out only with other black kids, and those who bounced back and forth between black and non-black friends. I was in the second group. And with all that switching back and forth, my voice switched too. And it still does. Like when I'm on the phone with my sister.
Girl, you better ask somebody. I do not know what you are talking about.
It's not something I'm always conscious of. Sometimes it just sort of happens.
Yeah, he came in looking all crazy, acting all crazy, talking all crazy. I was like, you better back off.
Now, as an adult, I have fun with it.
You all up in my Kool-Aid, you don't even know the flavor.
But as a kid, it wasn't always this way. Finding my voice was, well, just painful. At school, being told I sounded white meant only one thing. I wouldn't be eating my corn dog and tater tots at the black kids' lunch table. But that was then. Nowadays, in some schools, corn dogs and tater tots have been replaced with tofu dogs and a green salad. It got me wondering if the conversation among teens may have changed too. So I went to a place where I thought I might find some black teens who've been accused of talking white, the skate park.
Black people have told me I talk white before. Like, I don't know, like, what it means to, like, talk white or talk black.
Yeah. They be saying I talk white. I get pissed off. They only do it because my mom's white, you know, so I have to speak respectable. And they think since I'm black, I have to act ghetto and be stupid.
I guess talking white would be, like, I don't know. Like, I want to say, like, speaking proper, I guess. Like how most white people talk or most normal people talk, you know?
This conversation got me interested in talking to someone whose job depends on his voice.
I'm Joshua Johnson. I'm the morning newscaster for KQED Public Radio.
Johnson's been in radio for years. He's African American, and he sounds pretty similar when he's on the air.
It's Morning Edition on KQED. I'm Joshua Johnson.
And when he's talking with me in person.
Is this your radio voice?
This is my voice.
This is your voice. So is your...
People ask me that a lot. They're like, do your radio voice. I'm like, have we not been talking for 15 minutes? This is it. You know, my goal on the radio
is to sound like me. I don't want to
sound like the news anchor who is enunciating the headlines at you.
But Johnson says he has experienced surprise reactions when people realize he's black.
We did a show about race and diversity in Silicon Valley. And somewhere in the show I mentioned that I'm African American. I forget what the context was, but somewhere in the show I mentioned it. And I got an email from a listener who basically wrote, "I never would have guessed that you were black."
Johnson says he doesn't let these reactions about his race really bother him. Like me, he's heard it all. The patronizing tone. "You're so articulate. You speak so well." But Johnson thinks this ignorance can also be a lesson in disguise, to show us assumptions we often make about race.
Did you respond to that?
I did. I told him it was a very good thing that you as a white person have to stop looking at me as a black person as other and presume that I sound like everybody on BET.
I asked Johnson if he'd ever been accused of sounding white when he was growing up. He tells me that he not only heard the accusation, but he grew up with black adults insinuating that it was preferable. To sound white was to sound high quality.
In my hometown of West Palm Beach, Florida, I remember the choir director, Ms. Richardson, said, "I want you to sound so good that if I put you on stage behind a curtain and had you sing to the audience, everyone would swear you were white."
To sound professionally marketable or quote-unquote proper, it's the goal most parents and teachers set out for kids. I mean, saying the word "ain't" in my house would warrant a side glare from mom that was just as bad as a spanking. Johnson says he was very aware of this as a child.
I always knew there was something blessed and something cursed about the way I spoke. I knew that it would open doors for me, and I knew that none of my friends was behind those doors.
But what is it about the fear of those doors closing because of the way we sound? There's actually a name for it. It's called linguistic profiling, a term coined by Professor John Baugh, a PhD at Stanford University. He did a study where he selected 5 racially diverse cities in the Bay Area to inquire about housing for rent. First, he called using an African-American accent.
"Yes, my name is Michael Davis. I was calling to see if you might have any houses for rent that might be available."
Then he called again, this time with a Latino accent.
"Hello, this is Juan Ramirez. I'm calling about the apartment you have advertised in the paper."
With these accents, Ball was told nothing was available. But when he switched to what he called a neutral accent, he was often invited to see the properties. I was linguistically profiled recently. I was working on a story that involved a support group for African Americans. Many of them had a criminal record. At first, they seemed very open to being interviewed, but then they turned cold. Days turned into weeks of messages without a return phone call. When we finally met, one of the coordinators laughed. "I would have gotten back to you sooner if I would have known you were black." And although we both laughed together about her comment, I had a moment of deflation, like eating that corn dog alone at lunch. But as for my voice, whether it works to my advantage or not, it's just the one I got. For Cross Currents, I'm Lila Day.
This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Today we're talking about identity. In that last piece, we heard how people, whether intentionally or not, can pass as another race just by changing the way they talk. But passing can also be a full-time intentional endeavor. The U.S. has a long history of African Americans who lived as white in their daily lives.
Particularly during the Jim Crow era, which was the era of legalized segregation, there were many advantages to passing as white.
That's Allison Hobbs. She's a professor of history at Stanford.
Pass as white meant to get a better job. It meant to live in a better neighborhood, to being treated with much more respect and dignity than the way African Americans were often treated.
Hobbs' new book is called A Chosen Exile, A History of Racial Passing in American Life. Allison Hobbs joined me in studio, and I asked her to share a story about her own family.
My aunt told me a story about a relative of ours who lived on the south side of Chicago. She grew up like any other black child of her day. But when she graduated from high school, her mother made a decision for her that she was not happy with at all. Her mother decided that because she looked white, she was very light-skinned, that she would move far away from the south side of Chicago and from this very historic black neighborhood where she had grown up. And she would move to Los Angeles and she would assume the life of a white woman. Now, the relative did not want to leave Chicago. She didn't want to leave the only family and friends and community that she had ever known. But her mother was insistent, and the matter was decided. But in her mother's defense, she really believed that this was the very best thing that she could do for her daughter. This was a way that she could create a better life for her daughter. So
she goes to LA.
She goes to LA. She marries a white man. She has children who know nothing about her background. And years later, she receives a very inconvenient phone call from her mother. And her mother is calling to tell her that her father is dying and that she must come home immediately. And despite these dire circumstances, our relative would never return to Chicago's South Side.
She didn't go.
She explained that she was a white woman now and there was simply no turning back. And there really wasn't. I mean, it would have been almost impossible for her to go back. What would she have told her husband? What would she have told her children? So she didn't see any available avenue to return. And what she said to her mother was, you know, this is the life that you made for me. I didn't want to do this, but this is the life that you made for me. And these are the consequences that we have to live with.
And you heard that story and what?
I heard that story and it just stuck with me. And it made me really see passing through a different lens, particularly to think about passing less as a story about gain, which it often is. But hearing her story made me really think about all there was to lose.
And how common was this, really?
You know, it's a great question. It's really hard for us to know just how many people passed. And part of the reason why it's so hard to quantify is that there are some people who pass permanently. There are others who pass just during the day, just to get a better job. And this was often referred to as 9-to-5 passing. Many of the people who passed really covered their tracks. They did not want to be found. But I felt very lucky that when I went out to do the research and when I went into the archives, I was surprised at how many stories I was able to find. So while we can't quantify it, we can see that it was a pretty common phenomenon, and particularly because it was a way of advancing oneself and sort of working around and negotiating around some of the constraints of a racist society.
You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba, and I'm speaking with Allison Hobbs, author of A Chosen Exile, A History of Racial Passing in America. What do you think passing fundamentally does to a person's self-image? Because you can trick society on the outside, but you know what you are and who you are.
Absolutely. So by the 1940s and 50s, there's a lot of discussion in the black press, and there are a lot of testimonials that are published where African Americans who have passed have said, I'm through with this. This has been incredibly taxing emotionally, psychologically. I don't want to do this anymore. So by the 1950s, and I think this really corresponds with the launch of the civil rights movement, it corresponds with the kind of collapse of some of the barriers that were erected through the Jim Crow regime. It corresponds with the opening of some employment opportunities, particularly white collar employment opportunities, where African Americans Americans are starting to kind of rethink this decision to pass, and they're starting to say, you know, it's just not worth the costs.
And so the civil rights movement comes and then passing starts to taper off, or what happens?
I think what happens is the civil rights movement and the collapse of some of the barriers of Jim Crow, we're moving into this period where there's kind of a resurgence of racial pride and a kind of sense of racial community. And passing just starts to feel kind of incongruous with that time period. I'm sure that people continue to pass even after the civil rights movement. You know, I'm sure it's a phenomenon that certainly continued because there was still much to gain by being white.
There still is much to gain by being white.
Absolutely. There still is so much to gain by being white. So I'm sure that passing continued then. I'm sure it continues now. But I think we can look at the civil rights movement as being kind of a turning point in this history.
But let's fast forward to today. There are more opportunities for people of color. But there's also an increasing number of people, especially here in the Bay Area in California, who are biracial, who are multiracial, who can pass easily as white. So I'm wondering, do you see it happening today?
In the earlier period, you know, you really only had two choices. You could live as black or you could pass as white. Whereas today we have a much broader range, a much larger landscape of racial identities that are recognized in our society. My book focuses on passing, racial passing, where African Americans are passing as white, but that's really just a subset of a much larger phenomenon. You know, there's stories of gay men and women who passed as straight, there's stories of women who passed as men who passed as women, Catholics who passed as Protestant. I mean, there's just such a wide range of different forms of passing that kind of thinking about that larger landscape helps us to sort of look at this one particular type of passing that particularly interested me and to sort of see the way that kind of makes us think differently or look more widely or to sort of consider American, the particular dynamics of American race relations.
That's Allison Hobbs, author of A Chosen Exile, A History of Racial Passing in American Life. You can find a link to her recent TED Talk at kalw.org. Click CrossCurrents. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Human beings like to categorize things. That's how we make sense of the world, from ethnicity to politics, from music genres to gender. Look around you. Many spaces are designated for either men or women, bathrooms, clothing stores, hair salons. But some people don't subscribe to being a man or a woman, like Clem Breslin, who identifies as genderqueer. Genderqueer is a complicated term, but basically it's a catch-all for people who don't identify with conventional gender categories. This shows up in a lot of ways, from the way Clem dresses to the pronouns Clem prefers.
Clem told me not too long ago that they preferred the pronoun they, as opposed to she, which is the pronoun I used to use.
That's Hannah Young, Clem's girlfriend. You'll hear Hannah refer to Clem as they throughout the next story. And if you're thinking, hey, using they is not grammatically correct, well, Clem gets that all the time. KALW's Christina Loring sat down with Clem Breslin to discuss what daily life is like when you live in a world that wants to see you either as a man or a woman.
My full name is Clementine, which is probably the most feminine, like, antebellum name you can think of. So I go by Clem, which coincidentally is a pretty androgynous name. And I prefer, like, they as a pronoun, something gender neutral. I also identify as, like, a boy, B-O-I. Yeah, that's me. I think a boy is someone that embodies like all those aspects of boyishness, you know, like the playfulness of it, you know, the dress, like the mannerisms, you know, and I don't necessarily think of it as on any kind of continuum, like, you know, leading up into manhood or something. I just think of it as something like fixed in its own space. And I just think of it as staying a boy and being that every day.
What will I wear today? I usually wear a lot of earth tones. It's kind of my jam. A lot of my friends actually call me ET, and it stands for earth tone. I have a record player in my room, so while I'm getting dressed, I usually put on a record.
I think it's a Paul Simon morning. This is the best sound in the world. My body is pretty neutral looking, I'd say. Like, I'm pretty flat chested and I'm tall, kind of ropey, gangly. So my body is, it's not like a desirable, like feminine body to begin with. And yeah, so I'm lucky it's like a good palette to blend masculine things on. When you're genderqueer or trans, you are taking what is written on your body and like reversing the script or rewriting the script completely and dressing it in the way that feels truest to yourself. And it's really liberating and radical and scary. Not to toot my own horn, but I think it's one of the most like modern ways to think of your gender. And I feel really proud of that. I'm ready to go out into the world. One of the moments in life, in day-to-day, that I dread the most is when people see me, you know, I'm tall, I don't wear makeup, I look boyish, and I will, if someone's ringing me up at a counter, they'll say,
"Oh, hello, sir."
And then there'll be that flash on their face, like, of embarrassment. And they'll say,
"Oh, sorry, ma'am.
And I dread that. I'm gonna kiss all the freckles off your face.
You're a man.
This is my girlfriend, Hannah Young.
This is my boyfriend, Clem Breslin.
She's got kind of a pale complexion, lots of freckles.
The first word I think of when I think of how Clem looks is really dapper.
I'm super weak for freckles. But just like a really striking natural beauty.
Definitely androgynous or masculine.
This is the first relationship I've had where I kind of like located my gender queerness and shared it with the person I was seeing. I can't really exactly remember what I said, do you?
Yeah, it was a really, I mean, I'll never forget actually that day.
It's time to get that baby.
It was really early on, and it was like a morning, like a Saturday morning, and Clem told me.
I don't, especially in bed, I don't see my body as feminine. I see my body as more on like the masculine spectrum, and I really like the language to reflect that.
So Clem told me not too long ago that they preferred the pronoun they, as opposed to she. Some of the things that I've done to kind of help me start using they really consistently. It's really important to talk about a person when they're not in the room with the same pronoun that you would use if they were. Doing just a lot of like kind of like repetitive stuff like Clem they, Clem they, Clem they, like honestly can help. So the other language aspects, then just getting a lot of clarity like on what those were and what ones were like, you know, sexy and hot and which ones were like a big turn off. I guess I wouldn't be like, "You're so like beautiful and
pretty
and like what a pretty girl." Like, what a pretty girl.
Gender is everywhere, and there's almost nowhere you can go that doesn't have some kind of gender placard or gendered language or something there. It's, yeah, there feel like there are almost no neutral environments. I don't pass as a man, and I mean, I look boyish, but I wouldn't feel comfortable going into a men's bathroom, so I go into ladies' bathrooms in malls and public places, and I've been called out before by women saying I'm in the wrong place. Women have just turned to me when, like, they see me washing my hands and said, like,
You know this is a woman's bathroom, right? I think you're in the wrong place.
You know, things like that, that are calling me out and telling me that I shouldn't be there. My ideal, like, scenario in any setting would be for and nobody to gender anyone, like, upon seeing them. But, you know, I have faith that, like, we're, you know, as the decades progress, so, like, it's going to become more and more common to stay in the gray.
And that's it for today's Cross Currents. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at KALW and email us at news@kalw.org. It's because of you that we can proudly say we're listener-supported public radio. Our team includes Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Angela Johnston, Ted Muldoon, Truk Nguyen, Edwin Okongo, James Rowlands, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producer was Jeremy Dalmas. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.
I want you to get together. I want you to get together.